All right, we're beginning here on the Chaf Bet Amud Aleph by the two dots. The Gemara begins Siman Shanvai Shanas, which is actually the acronym for all the upcoming Amoraim that ask questions. So each one of the letters represents an Amora who's about to ask a question. And Mati Filav Rav Hoshaya. Rav Hoshaya presented the following question: V'lichshov Nami Hazorei Benachal Eitan. Why don't we add on additional lavin that a person could violate in this one instance of plowing? In the Mishnah, remember, it says that you can be choresh telem echad, you can be plow one furrow, v'chayav alav mishmum shmona lavin, and then you'll be chayav for eight different lavin. So over here, you can have the Amoraim presenting other possibilities of lavin the Mishnah could have included. The first of which is, what happens if he plows v'nachal eitan, v'zarete mi'ocho, and the lav that he's violating is from here, asher lo ya'aved bo v'lo yizareya. It is the location in which they do the Egla Arufa, where the Pashtut of the Pasuk is that this is describing the nature of that Nachal Eitan, but Chazal interpret it as a requirement after the Egla Arufa is done down by this Nachal Eitan, this riverbed, is that that location not be worked and not be planted. If this individual in the process of planting or plowing is doing it in this location, then they'll be in violation of an additional lav. So that would be something you could have added to the list, and it is in the same process of plowing that you would be in violation of that. Matkif lav Rav Chananya, v'lichshov nami hamocheket Hashem behalichato. Someone who erases the Shem Hashem while he is going or walking. V'azharatei mihocha. And azhara comes from here. V'baratem et shemam. Lo tasun kein l'Hashem elokeichem. That you have to wipe out the names of the Avodah Zarah. You may not do such to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We actually saw this yesterday's daf at the end, which was that Ashrehem tisrefun be'esh. You should be burning up their Avodah Zarah or the Asherah by fire. Lo tasun kein l'Hashem elokeichem. Don't do the same thing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So yesterday the Gemara used the lotase to say that you're not allowed to burn hektesh. Over here the Gemara is using it, lotase nekem and Hashem elokeichem, is don't wipe out the Shem Hashem. The one that we're bringing now is much more common, limud. The one that was brought before is a much less common usage of it, and seems to indicate that there are malkot for wasting away hektesh, or burning hektesh, which we don't always see. Number two is that the Ashrehem tisrefun be'esh is not as juxtaposed as Ibaratem et Shemam is to the Pasuk Lota Sun Kein L'Hashem Elokeichem, and that's why normally the limud is the one that we're bringing now. But the Gemara uses it for both limudim over here, and there are some that therefore count that as a lav in terms of burning up hektesh, ruining hektesh, destroying hektesh, that there is a lav associated with it based on what we saw in the Gemara yesterday. But then here we have an additional item that is also covered by that same lo tasun kein l'Hashem elokeichem, and then that could run you into a problem of becoming a lav shibiklalot, but then you wouldn't get malkot for it, because if it has multiple manifestations of the same lav, then it becomes a lav shibiklalot, and you wouldn't get malkot for the isur that is generated. So again, with this, also you would have to suggest that it's a case in which the plowing does the erasure. Somehow he placed the Shem Hashem by the plow, and then the plow runs over it, and through the plowing, he wipes away the Shem Hashem, and therefore be a part of the action that he's doing while plowing. Matkif la Rabbi Abahu, lichshov nami akotseitz et beharto. Also, why don't we add to the list someone who cuts off his tzarat? And the lav comes from here, which is hishamer benega tzarat. And we have a principle that called hishamer pen ba'al or lashon lo taseh. So hishamer benega tzarat means you may not remove tzarat from your body. So if you have tzarat on the body and you remove it, that's a violation of a lav. So over here, kotzeitzit be'arto should generate a lav. So you're going to ask the question, which the Gemara asked yesterday, what does that have to do with the plowing itself? And that is, Rabbi Chananya ben Hachinai said in the Mishnah, why don't you add on the fact that he's wearing kilayim? The Rabbanon's response to that was, it has nothing to do with plowing. Everything else that we listed is connected to the plowing or the location where you plow. Over here, you're adding other lavin, which can be done anywhere. They have nothing to do with the circumstance or situation in which you are in. Seemingly, this statement of Rabbi Abo falls into that same category, which is taking off a tzarat has nothing to do with plowing. So you have one of two options here. One option is to say that Rabbi Abbah was speaking in the position of Rabbi Hananya ben Achinai. If you're going to add things like wearing kilayim, why don't you add in also pulling off sarat? But that does open up Pandora's box, because then you can come up with many isurim. It could be chewing on an avela at the same time. You could be eating basar b'chalaf. And you could come up with so many scenarios. The other way to deal with it is to suggest that he does it through the plowing, that he puts his foot under the plowshare, or he sticks a part of his body under the plowshare, and it pulls off the tzarat as it runs over it. Yeah. So that's another possibility. Would then bring it into the realm of the other Isurim that we're speaking about here. But clearly, it seems that we are drifting a little afar in terms of this. Matkiv la'abayim, lichshov nami, emiziach choshen mi'alai fod, ve'mesir b'de'arom. So again, here, you seem to be far afloat from what we were speaking about in the Mishnah. One of them is the removal of the choshen from the ephod, which is a restriction in the big day kohen gadol. The second one is removing the handles from the aron. The badim of the aron have to be there. They cannot be removed. And here is the lav. Lo yusuru b'de aron. The aron's badim may not be removed from the aron itself. And the pashtut of the pasuk is that it's a statement of the utility of the chains that hold the choshen to the ephod. The chains are there, shalo yizach choshen mi'al ephod. But nevertheless, Chazal interpreted it to mean that you can't remove the choshen from the ephod. Again, over here, you're running into that same problem. So, first of all, you can see in the Rivan already, when we're taking off the handles of the aron, that is to use them as the handles for the plowshare. So that you're utilizing the Badei Aron as something as part and parcel of the action of the plowshare. And Meziach HaChoshen Me'alai Fod seems like he put that on. That still runs you into the problem of similar to Rabbi Hananya ben Achinai, is that you're wearing something which doesn't seem to be integral to the plowing or the violation over here. And so then you have to either explain it that he somehow pulled it off while he was plowing, and similarly with the handles of the Aron, the plowing caused a pulling of the choshen off the Kohen Gadol and the Badim off of the Aron. That's the suggestion of the Aruch Haner, but it does run into problems because then you can come up with even more lavin that are of a similar nature to this type of lav. Somebody uses Avodah Zorah as the handles or a part of the plow in order to do that. And as a raz from here, b'lo yibak b'yadcha mi'uma min acherim, which was, we also asked a similar question yesterday, and then you'd have to throw on top of that, lo tevi to'iva al-beitecha, maybe there's additional isurim that come with avodah zarah. Matkiv la ravina, b'lech shov nami akutseitz ilanot tovot. What about cutting down fruit trees? Bazeretei mi'acha, and the lav comes from here, v'imenu tochau, v'oto lo tichrot. When you set siege to a city, you are allowed to utilize the fruit trees, eat the fruit from the trees, but you may not destroy the tree, you may not cut down the tree. So here, if you use that tree to become the plow, or through your plowing you uproot the fruit tree, then again here you have a violation in taking down a fruit tree, and this might be subsumed under the broader context of Bal Tashchitu, which is that you're not allowed to destroy things, you're not allowed to ruin things that have utility for no purpose or reason at all. And similarly over here, we have this view with regards to fruit trees, that those aren't made for wood, they're made for their fruit. As long as they are productive trees, you don't have a right to cut down the trees. And in that context, the Rambam seems to put this as part of any Bal Tashchit, any type of destructive engagement, where you are ruining otherwise good productive assets, that's a problem. Others see it very particular to the fruit trees and to the supply of food and fruit, that you shouldn't be uprooting them. So Amar Rabbi Zeira, the Rabbi Mani, V'lech shov nami kigon damar, shvua shlo echrosh biyom tov. Why don't we say you can add on another isur, which is he took a shvua that he won't plow on Yom Tov. So not only is he in violation of plowing on Yom Tov, he's now in violation of his Shvuah. Hatam lo kachalo Shvuah. So here we're getting a little introduction into the next Masechta. Over there, it's not a Shvuah that is chal, because Mushpa ba'omed ma'ar Sinaihu. That is a Shvuah on something that he's already required to do. You're already required to keep Yom Tov and not to plow on Yom Tov. to take a shvuah to reinforce what you're already obligated in through a previous shvuah. Now that could be in one of two ways. It could be a shvuah that you've taken, that you already articulated a shvuah to do something or not do something, and then you take a subsequent shvuah about the same matter. Over there again, that's a shvuah that's trying to lay on top of a shvuah that exists. It doesn't work. So similarly, you also have a shvuah that can pre-exist, which is the Torah. The Torah is an obligation through shvuah that you have to keep the Torah. If you try to take a shvuah on top of the shvuah Torah, it doesn't have any effect or impact. So similarly over here, you already are obligated to not plow. You take a shvuah not to plow, you haven't done anything incremental that would make this shvuah be chal, because it's just trying to sit on top of an existing shvuah. And in shvuah chal al shvuah. A shvuah cannot sit on top of another shvuah. Over here, some ask about a neder, which is interesting, because we do know from Masechet Nedarim that one of the key differences between a shvuah and a neder is ein shvuah chal al mitzvah. That a shvuah has no ability to be chal on a mitzvah, but a neder can be chal al a mitzvah, or a neder can have impact on a mitzvah. Mostly because of the difference in the way that they function. A shvuah is on the gavra, whereas the neder is on the chefetz. And so you can take what's called nidrei mitzvah. You can take a neder, whether it's to commit yourself to do a mitzvah, or to prevent yourself from engaging in a lo taseh. So what some rishonim conclude over here is that you see from here that neder only works in a structural form where nidrei mitzvah, where you're doing it in order to do a mitzvah taseh, which means that you are taking a neder to be zariz, to do the mitzvah taseh, or you're taking a negative neder, which will prevent you from doing something active in the Torah. But over here, you're saying lo tachrosh, I will not plow. So that falls under neither of those categories. It's not a reinforcement of a positive commandment, and it's not a neder that you're taking against doing a positive commandment. For instance, if you are oser the sukkah on yourself, and then you can't be mekayim the mitzvah of sukkah. There the neder is chal on the chefetz of the sukkah, which then prevents you from doing the mitzvah. But over here, you're taking a neder to reinforce a lota, say, in the Torah. And so some rishonim say from here you see that you can't take such a neder. Such a neder is impossible to take. Others suggest that maybe you could take such a neder, and the Gemara goes a different route over here. Instead of going to the root of neder, it goes to the root of shvuah to try to explain it better. V'amarlei kagon damar shvuah shloachrosh ben bachol ben beyom tov. It's a case where he takes a shvuah that he won't plow, not on a weekday, not on yom tov. Tamigo dechalalei shvuah bechol, since the shvuah takes effect for the weekdays, chalalei nami beyom tov. It takes effect for yom tov as well. So even though you are priorly engaged in terms of a shvuah with Yom Tov, since this shvuah that you're taking now includes more than Yom Tov, that extra that you're adding in here makes it into a shvuah kolel. Shvuah kolel means that it incorporates a greater scope than you are already obligated in. When it comes to isurim, we have a general principle of ein isur chal al isur. You cannot have one isur sit on top of another isur. That's partly what's going on here with the shvuah. You can't generate a new restriction on top of an existing restriction. Even those that hold ein isur chal al isur, there are exceptions to that. The exceptions are isur mosif, isur kolel. Now, not everybody agrees that there are such exceptions, and not everybody agrees to both of those exceptions. But over here, the Gemara is speaking what's called an isur kolel, and saying through an isur kolel, you can overcome the problem of ein isur chal al isur. The difference between an Isur Mosif and an Isur Kolel is that an Isur Kolel expands the scope of the restriction, and an Isur Mosif expands the severity of the restriction. So for instance, if you had something that was already Asur, and then you add on top of it an Isur Hana'ah, until now it was Asur Ba'achila, now through whatever Isur it is, now it becomes also Isur Ba'ana'ah. That's an Isur Mosif. It adds on additional restrictions, severity to the same Isur, and therefore it would be chal on the Isur beforehand. Or, the severity of the punishment is upgraded. Before it was only a chiyuv malkot, now it becomes a chiyuv karet, it becomes a chiyuv mita. That would also be an upgrading of the severity of the mitzvah. And in that case, we would say Isur chal al Isur. This is a case of Isur kolel, where you're not changing the severity of the item, you're changing the scope of those individuals or objects that are captured by the shvuah. So you have that in cases of arayot. In a case where someone is restricted to the individual because they are a relative, then that individual who is their relative also gets married. So when they get married, that's an Iser Kolel. Because until this point in time, the only people that were restricted to this woman were her relatives. Once she gets married, even people who are not her relatives are now restricted. So the scope of the restriction now is expanded. Since the scope is expanded, not only are those people who are not married to her and not her relatives now restricted in her because she's an Eshet Ish, even her relatives now are restricted because of Eshet Ish. Even though they were already restricted either because it was mother-in-law, it was a sister, whatever the restriction was, now you added on top of that Eshet Ish, which now includes more people. The scope of the Isur is expanded. And you've done the similar thing over here, which is you have an Isur Kolel, which is the scope of what you're including now is greater. Before, you were only Mushva Bomid Mihar Sinai. The Shvuah that you had only included Yom Tov. Now you expand it to include not only Yom Tov, but also weekdays. That expansion of the Shvuah lets it be Chal on another mitzvah. Mide ita b'sheila loktani. So Gemara says, no problem. That one we can deal with. By the way, this is the first time the Gemara gives an answer. The Gemara asks question after question. Why don't you add this lav? Why don't you add this lav? Why don't you add this lav? Silence on the Gemara. No answer whatsoever. Here you have one answer given to the last question, which is anything that can be undermined, we don't include in the Mishnah. We're talking about violations that are absolute, not violations that are subject to the possibility of something being matir neder or matir the shvuah. Because if you can do that, then it's not a certainty that that violation will take place because you can always undermine the isur that is created. That does run you into a problem because if you remember yesterday, we said that one of the restrictions over here is a restriction of the fact that the item was kodesh. And so one of the things you can do, kodesh is a kind of neder and therefore you can undermine that. So Gemara says, hello, how could it be, vary Ekdesh? You have the case of Ekdesh yesterday, how can you claim that things that are capable of being unwound aren't included in the Mishnah? Hekdesh is a classic case of Neder or Shvuah that can be unwound if you go to get a Hatarat Chacham. So Bibachor. So this is how we explained the Gemara already yesterday, knowing the influence of the Gemara later on, which is that the Hekdesh we're speaking about here is Bechor, which is Lo Tavod B'Bechor Shorecha, that you're not allowed to do work with your Bechor. Over there, Bechor is Kedusha Mirechem, and there you can't unwind it through a She'ila, because it's inherent Kedusha. It's not Kedusha that was generated through articulation. Barei Nazir isn't one of the things in the Mishnah a Nazir. Mazir says, B'Nazir Shimshon. It's a case of a Nazir Shimshon. The unique aspect of Nazir Shimshon is that he was born a Nazir. Similar to the way the Bechor is born with its Kedusha, Shimshon was also born a Nazir. So it wasn't that there was an acceptance of a Neder, it was a Nizirut that existed Minabetin. And that's why you can't call it B'Sheila. Mar says, Nazir Shimshon, Barit Muya the Meitimhu? Wait a minute, Nazir Shimshon, Shimshon himself, has no restriction against becoming Tamei Meit. The Gemara in Nazir already speaks about how that is, or how we know that. It speaks about how he killed the Plishtim by his own hands, which would have made him Tamei and been a violation of his Nizirot. Then the Gemara figures out maybe he didn't kill them, he just made them lying on their deathbed and they died later on, so he didn't really kill them. In the end, the Gemara says, we have a Mesora, that Shimshon was not restricted in Tumah. And we know from the instructions of the Malach to Manoach and his wife that the only restrictions are the wine products and cutting the hair. We never see any restrictions with regards to Tum'ah. And so the Gemara asks, the reason you put a Nazir in the Mishnah is because he became Tamei. The place where he's plowing is Tamei, and therefore he's in a violation of his Nizirut because of the Tum'ah that's there. But if you're telling me he's a Nazir Shimshon doesn't include Tamei Meitim. So that would make this whole statement about the fact that anything b'she'ila doesn't work, now we've run into a real problem, because Nizirut is subject to she'ila. Now, this little clip in the Gemara is very interesting, because is it really possible to become a Nazir Shimshon? How do you become a Nazir Shimshon if it is min abetin? So the Rivan says something stunning. He says, b'Nazir Shimshon, it's a case, ayde malach. Kibel nizirut alav. Through a malach, he now has a nizirut. Da'o en lo she'la, ditzivu shalom alohu. That has no undermining because It is something that is commanded from the heavens. The Rivan seems to implicate, and he says it in the next one, Adam shemekabel niziruto aidei malach. Someone who accepted nizirut through a malach, he seems to indicate that this nazir came about through a malach, telling him that he's going to be a nazir. Now, if you could have read the Gemara and even the Rivan in the first instance, to just say that that is the nature of nizirut Shimshon. Nizirut Shimshon came from a malach, and therefore it has these characteristics to it, then you could say, if you become a Nazir Shimshon, you take on the character traits of what was a Nazir Shimshon. You could make such a claim, and that means that it wouldn't be able to be unwound, despite the fact that you articulate becoming a Nazir Shimshon. One of the character traits of Nazir Shimshon is that you're unable to remove it. So that's a possibility, but that runs you into a problem that you're taking a neder to be a Nazir Shimshon. And so that makes it that it should be subject to Sheila. And that's why the Rivan goes the path that he does, which is, it must be a case here where the person had a malach. Tell them that they are a Nazir. There is an alternate view in the Mishonim that the Rivan brings here at the end, which he dismisses, which is the possibility that the father accepted the Nizirut. The father accepted the Nizirut on behalf of the fetus and says when the fetus is born, they will be a Nazir. And a parent, or really a father, is allowed to accept on behalf of a child a nizirut and put him into a nizirut. So you have this simulation of what happened with the malach. Just like the malach made Shimshon into a nazir while he was in utero, and then when he was born, he was a nazir. So too, the father here commits the baby while he's in utero to being a nazir, and therefore he's born a nazir, and he has no way to unwind it because he wasn't the one who made the neder nizirut. The Rivan rejects that explanation for the following reason, which is, you're saying to me it has to be something that cannot be unwound. The truth is, you're right, the baby can't unwind it, but the father can unwind it. The father is the one who took a neder nizirut, and he can go be shoel or nidro. So then, what's the suggestion? The father has already passed away. So if the father passed away, then there's no asking or removing the neder because he already is gone. The Rivan says, that doesn't change anything. At the moment the neder nizirut was entered into, it was a type of nizirut that could have been unwound. Doesn't matter now that you're unable to unwind it because the father had passed away, but at the time you took the neder nizirut, could have been unwound? Yes, the answer is yes. Something happened that doesn't allow you to unwind it, that doesn't mean it wasn't subject to being unwound. And so therefore he rejects that explanation, but just know that many Rishonim use that as the explanation here because it's very hard to understand how you get to be a Nazir Shimshon and have something that simulates the effect of no articulation but yet being a Nazir. So the two options are, again, somebody else imposes it on you and you're a Nazir min ha-beten, or, like the Rivan suggests, it came ayidei malach. So that, the Gemara says, now we're stuck. That can't be the answer as to why the Mishnah did not include a shvu'ah also. Elahai Tana Isser Kolel Leitleh. So this is what I discussed with you before, that this Tana doesn't hold of Isser Kolel, or in essence, Ein Isser Kolel Isser, and that's even in the case of an Isser Kolel. The hierarchy in terms of things that can overcome an Ein Isser Kolel Isser, Isser Mosif is a stronger type of Isser, and therefore it could help you in the case of Ein Isser Kolel Isser, even if you don't hold of Isser Kolel. Isser Mosif is because you're inherently, the object is becoming more severe. It's about the object itself. It's about the Isser itself. Whereas Isser Kolel is just an expansion of the scope and is less integrally connected. So there are Tanaim that believe that Ein Isser Chala Isser, that's true, even by Isser Kolel, although they would still allow an Isser Mosif. And there's still other Tanaim who believe that none of these can override Ein Isser Chala Isser. So what you have to say is our Tana is one of those Tanaim that believes that Ein Isser Chalal Isser is strong enough that even an Isser Kolel will not override that situation. Now, as far as the other cases in the Mishnah, there's nothing that the Gemara answers. How about all these other Lavin? So the Balei Tosafot asked, Kasha, the Hashta Parech Tuva. Here the Gemara is listing off question after question, and V'lo Mishani Midei, and the Gemara makes no peep, doesn't answer a single time. V'tzareich Lamar, the Tana Vishier. What you have to say is that the list in the Mishnah is not exhaustive. He laid a list, but you could have expanded the list. Now that's very interesting because the Gemara yesterday, when Ula raised such a situation, says, what are you talking about? You can't say Tana Vishier. When the Tana mentions a number 8, How could you say Tana Vishier and say, oh, he left out things? If he left out things, then make a list without a number. You make a number to the list that says this is the exhaustive list. There's nothing more than that. Here the Baal Tosef order giving the exact answer that Ula said was impossible to give yesterday. So the Baal Tosefot over here make a chiluk ve omer aram, whether that's the Ram Mimurtenberg, or is that the Rabbeinu Meir, the son-in-law of Rashi, the low dummy. These cases are not exactly the same. Because before, you had the possibility of enumerating two lavin within Yom Tov. The Mishnah mentions Yom Tov as a problem, and Choresh be Yom Tov. And the Gemara wants to know, why don't you include other Isurim that were associated with Yom Tov? Over that, he says, Tana Vishier doesn't make any sense. Because the Mishnah already mentioned Yom Tov, you can't say that he left something out. He mentioned Yom Tov. He's going to mention Yom Tov. He better mention everything that's covered by the lav of Yom Tov. On the other hand here, the lavim that you're adding over here are totally independent lavim, which is that they have nothing to do with the list that's in the Mishnah. Over there, you can make a claim of Tana Vishier. So that's what the Baal Tosef would say the Gemara would answer, is that yes, it's not an exhaustive list. As far as anything that's in the list, you better cover all bases with things that are in the list. If it mentions Yom Tov in the list, better cover any Isur that violate. You can't say Tana Vishier there. On the other hand, if these are things that are not included in the list, there you can make a claim of Tana Vishier. It's not an exhaustive list. And that's how the Baal Tosafot say you deal with all these lavin that were listed by the Gemara, and the Gemara does not address them. Amar Rav Hoshaya, Hamarbia Shor Psulei HaMuktashim Lokesh Naim. Someone who breeds, crossbreeds in essence, an animal that is Psulei HaMuktashim, together with a Chulin animal, Lokesh Naim, he's subject to Malkot for two things, or twice. One for doing a voda with Psulei HaMukdashim, and one for the violation of Kilayim. Although there is an alternative girsa found in the Ktav Yad Manfort that says that just Lokeh, and leaves out the word Shnaim, which actually would make more sense here, that you get Malkot for the problem of Kilayim. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak HaManhig Bishor Psulei HaMukdashim Lokeh. Someone who leads a shor Psulei HaMukdashim ends up lokeh, ends up getting malkot. So here, whether it's a case where the individual hitches this animal up with another animal to pull a load, or in a situation where, according to Rivan, it's even this single animal is hitched up to a load and pulling it, and we're following what Tosafot says over here, that it can't be stam for leading the animal, because otherwise you would never be able to move around an animal that is of Psulei HaMukdashim. And therefore the case here must be a case where it is pulling something else or engaged in some sort of work activity. Again, you are lokeh. Shrei guf echadu, vasal katuv kishnei gufim. It is really one body, one animal, but the Torah treats it as two different animals. So now Psulei HaMukdashim is a category of animals that were once dedicated, ra'oi l'mizbeach, dedicated to go on the mizbeach, but then they got a blemish. The blemish disqualified them from going on the mizbeach. If the blemish is a permanent blemish, then the animal becomes what's otherwise known as psulei hamukdashim, which is that they're a kadosh, but the blemish prevents them from being used for their primary purpose, which was going on the mizbeach. What you do then is you can redeem them. You move the kedusha off this animal onto the money, and then you take the kedusha from the money, and you buy a korban with that money, transfer the kedusha to a new animal that can end up on the mizbeach. Once you redeem the animal, they are known as psulei hamukdashim, which is a form of chulin with restrictions, which is that you're allowed to eat the animal, that you can eat it, tamei b'tor yachdav can eat it, that's what we already saw, no restrictions of tuman tara, no restrictions of eating it. But on the other hand, there are certain restrictions based on the pasuk that you're allowed to shecht it and eat it. From there, the Gemara learns from that pasuk, tizbach velo gizai voda, you cannot shear it, basar velo chalav, you can eat the meat of it and you cannot milk it or use it for its milk, vachalta, you can eat it, velo leklavecha, and you can't give it to your dogs as dog food. So here you have restrictions about the way that you utilize the psulei hamukdashim when you want to eat the animal. So what the Rivan claims is, the Torah gives a din to this animal of partially chulin, partially mukdashim. And so the animal is really kilayim in the sense that it is half chulin, half kodesh. The half chulin is that you're allowed to eat it. they have kodesh is that you have restrictions about how you use it. You may not use it for shearings. You may not use it for its milk. You may not give it to your dogs. So that has half chulin, half kodesh. And then he claims that that's a form of kila'ayim, because it's not all chulim, it's not kodesh. And therefore, when you're marbiyat, when you have it mate with either an animal that's chulin or an animal that is kodesh, you are now in violation of an isur kila'ayim, because the kodesh and the chulin are kila'ayim echad b'sheni. And that's what he says here. Afilu imino. Even if you put it together with its own species, that because you are marbia chulin with kodeshim or kodeshim with chulin, that results in you being in violation of tilayim. B'chein b'manig. Same thing if you have them leading a cart or you have them pulling a plow. Afilu manigo b'fnei atzmo. And again, here the Ravan says, even if it does it by itself, the animal chulin with kodeshimu. You have a mix. An animal is half kodesh, half chulin, and that's tilayim with itself. And then you're now chayav for plowing with animals that are kilayim, even though it's one animal. The Rivan says, that's the explanation. But then he writes, velo shamati raya minalin dechulin v'kodeshim kilayim ze bezeh v'davar teimahu. He gives the explanation and says, I just don't know how it works. Since when do you find that chulin and kodeshim have a din of kilayim? Kilayim is different species. We don't find kilayim with different stadi of the animal, which is that if the status is chulin or status is kodesh, that doesn't mean that there's kilayim here. He says, that's what I learned, that's how I explain it, but I really don't know how it works. For that difficulty, the Rabbeinu Tam therefore comes up with an alternate explanation in order to say why there is kilayim over here. And you can see it in the Balei Tosafot, Perish HaKuntres, Kegir Sato, Rabbeinu Tam Perish B'inyan Acher. Rabbeinu Tam explains it completely differently. K'min chomer dichtiv bei katzvi v'cha'ayau. The Torah, when it describes the psulei hamikdashim, it describes the psulei hamikdashim katzvi v'cha'ayau. But here you have an atzvi and an ayau, which are kilayim echad b'sheni, and the Torah describes psulei hamikdashim katzvi v'cha'ayau. It describes it as being both of those animals. In that way, he says that there is a particular designation of psulei hamikdashim as being katzvi v'cha'ayau. And it says katzvi v'chayal three times, and the Gemara darshins from each one of these a restriction. One of those is the restriction here of marbiya kilayim, Rabbi Hoshaya's din. The other restriction is the din of Rabbi Yitzchak, which is a manhig. If you use these animals to plow or to pull a cart, then you're also in violation. So he says that it's a specific, in a sense, gzerat ha-katuv, that psulei hamikdashim have a status like a tzvi and an ayau. And tzvi and ayal are kilayim echad b'sheni, and therefore this animal, even though it's one entity, one goof, it still is a mix of two goofim, of tzvi and ayal. And that creates the problem for crossbreeding, and that creates the problem for manhig and kilayim, and it's all a derivative of the fact that they're called tzvi v'ayal. But that makes it into a gzeret ha-katuv, but explains where the kilayim problem comes from, instead of saying that it's a mix between kodesh and chulin. Alright, next Mishnah. Kama Malkin Oto. How many Malkot does he get? Okay, and this is the type of Mishnah you would have expected in the beginning of the Masechet Makot. Here we bump into it way at the end of Masechet Makot, after we learned about all different manifestations of Malkot. We learned about Galut. We learned about all these different things. And now finally we're coming around to Malkot. How do you give Malkot? What's the procedure? How many do you give? That's going to be explained by the upcoming Mishnayot, which is Kama Malkin Oto. How many does he get? 40 chaser achat. Gets 40 minus 1, or in essence, 39 malkot. Shenemar.
The pasuk says, by malkot, vayayim ben hakot ha-rasha, vihipilo ha-shofet, vihikau lefanav kedei rishato b'mispar. And then the next pasuk begins, 40 yakenu lo yosif, pen yosif la-koto alela makar rabav, nikla achicha le'enecha. So the Mishnah here reparses the psukim to join the b'mispar, the last word in the previous pasuk, with the arba'im of the upcoming pasuk. And it explains,
b'mispar arba'im, it says, by the number 40, minyan shehu. Now the girsa that we have in our Mishnah is samuch l'arba'im, but if you look in the Rishonim and in the upcoming Gemara, the word is not samuch, but rather skum. You can see how the letters could be mixed up, it's the same letters, but it's minyan skum l'arba'im. It is a number by which if you add on to it, it will reach 40. So that's what it means. In the Gemara, we'll see in a second, the drasha that tells you that, that when the Torah says 40, it doesn't literally mean 40, it rather means 39. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Arbaim Shleimot Huloke. Rabbi Yehuda says that you actually get full 40. The Torah says 40, you get 40. Ve'echan Huloke Etza Yitera. Where do you get that extra 40th one? So he says, Ben Ktefav. Gets it between his shoulders, on his back, between his shoulders. We'll get to this in the part of the Mishnah, which is how the person is getting the Malkot, and you understand what the nature of the Gemara's question is. Einom de'imoto, ela b'malkot ruyot lehishtalesh. You can only assess an individual to get Malkot with numbers that are divisible by 3. 39, obviously, is divisible by 3. And then any other permutation of Malkot that you would give him must be divisible by 3. So if you get an assessment that he can handle this many Malkot, and for instance it's 22 or 23, we would say that he can only get 21. If you're ready, you reach 24, then he'll get 24 because these numbers are divisible by 3. And that is because of the nature of how we divide up the way the Malkot are given to this individual between a third and two-thirds. So you need numbers that are divisible by 3, otherwise it won't work. Amdu lekabel arbaim. If they assessed him to take the full 40 malkot, veloke miktzat, and they got through a portion of them, amdosh ein yochol lekabel arbeim. And now all of a sudden they realize he's not going to make it. If we give him the full 40, he's not going to make it, and they need to downgrade the assessment of the individual. So you see a number of things from the Mishnah, the first of which is that a person has to be assessed as to his capacity to handle the malkot, because we're not trying to kill him over here. We're trying to give him Malkot that will be the equivalent of 40 Malkot. So the Torah says 40 or 39 Malkot are the standard that a person could handle and enough to dissuade the individual from engaging this behavior again. If a person is weaker than that, then we say let's assess the individual to simulate the effect of the 40 Malkot without actually giving him 40 Malkot. It's also a maximum. We're not going to give him more than the 39, 40 Malkot that are mentioned here. So in our situation, they assessed him up front to handle the full amount, and then all of a sudden, they realize that he's not going to make it with the 40, so they're going to cut the number down. Patur, then he is patur. It seems, from this case, it's a case where they already gave him, for instance, 18 out of the 39 that he was supposed to get, and then they say he can't handle anymore. We dismiss him and say he's done. He got what he got. He was already nitbazeh. He was already embarrassed in the Beit Din. He got his lashes. That's enough. We dismiss it, and he is discharged. Amdua the kabel shmonesre. On the other hand, if they assessed originally that he could handle 18, umishalaka, and as they start to hit him, amdo shiachol the kabel arbaim, they realize that he can handle much more than this, and they can go to 40. Patur. Again over here, he is patur, because they already began the process of giving him the malkot to 18. He was already nitbazeh, and since he was nitbazeh bebeitin, that discharges the obligation as far as the Malkot are concerned. So it seems from the Mishnah that we go the kula in both situations. Situation when they assess them for a larger number, and then as they're doing it, they realize they can't make it to the larger number, he's dismissed at the lower number. Or if up front they assess that he could take the lower number, and then afterwards they realize he could take more, he still gets away with doing the lower number. So that both those cases, you will get the 18, and it is in both situations because nitbazeh. He was already got his malkot in court, and therefore he is done. So now my time, the Gemara asks the question, how do you get to this number 39? It says 40 in the Torah. How can you tell me 40 is 39? Iktiv arba'im b'mispar. Had the Torah written that you get 40 by the number, havamina arba'im b'minyana. That would have meant 40. Arba'im b'mispar means exactly 40. The Torah doesn't write it that way, but rather the Torah writes b'mispar arba'im. It puts the mispar before the arba'im, which indicates that not that you want 40, the number, but rather the number to 40. And that's how the Gemara darshens it. Hashem yichtiv mispar arba'im, minyan shu sokeim et arba'im. It means a number that reaches 40. That's how the Gemara is reading, or the number that sums to 40, approaches 40, I mean it's the number right before 40. Because they put the word mispar before the arba'im. So the mispar is the number before 40. Rather than it being arba'im mispar, which means 40 is the number, here it's the number that will reach 40. Amar Rava, kama tipshai sharinshe, is a famous statement in the Gemara in Kiddushin. Rava says how foolish people are. The kaimi mikamei sefer Torah, they stand up when a sefer Torah goes by, they give kavod to a sefer Torah. Below kaimi mikame gavarabba, but they don't get it up in front of a Talmud Chacham. Dilu b'sefer Taraktiv arba'im. The Torah says 40. V'atu rabbanon and batzu chaduk. And rabbanon tell you it's 39. So here you see that the Chachamim, in a sense, have more power than the Torah. They're able to interpret the Torah when it says 40 to mean 39. How literally you take this is interesting. The Rambam, at least according to the Kesef Mishnah, took this so literally that he believes that min Torah, there really are 40 lashes. It's only midrabanan that we give 39 lashes. That's the way the Kesef Mishnah reads the Rambam. And therefore he says that it's a rabbinic injunction because we're afraid you might give him one too many. So how do we prevent you from making the mistake of giving him one too many? We take one down at the 39. So if you ever make a mistake and give him one too many, you'll get to 40, which is the din d'oraita, and not exceed the din d'oraita. But that's interesting to read it that way. 99% of the Rishonim read this simply as they have a limud. The Torah she'be'al peh can override Torah she'bichtav, or Torah she'be'al peh gives you the interpretation of Torah she'bichtav. And that's what's happening over here. The Chachamim have a Misora, which allows them to interpret the Torah she'bichtav in a certain manner. And that is what Rava is saying. The Torah she'bichtav is limited in its scope because it's a Torah she'be'al peh that explains the Torah she'bichtav. So why would you only stand up for a Sefer Torah, which is limited to that which is written in it, versus a Talmud Chacham, who can then interpret, or is empowered to interpret the Torah Shebichtav, and use the Misora in order to interpret the Torah Shebichtav. He has the Torah Shebaal Peh. And for that reason, you should stand up for Talmud Chacham. So in that way, they believe that the number Midoraita is 39, and the Limud is a real Limud, or you can claim it's a Misora, that was the case, and this is an asmachto. 99% explain it that way. The extreme is the Rambam explains it that the limud here is an asmachto, and the whole thing is really midrabanan and midoraita. There are 40 lashes. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Omer arba'im shlemot. So now, in terms of Rabbi Yehuda, it seems that according to the Rambam, you would just say that Rabbi Yehuda believes that doraita is 40, and there's no injunction min the chachamim to make it 39. According to the other Rishonim, you'll say he doesn't have a Misorah, that the Torah Shebaal Peh takes it down to 39, he believes you get 40. That'd be the easy way to explain him. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Rabim Shlemot, Am Rabbi Yitzchak, my time with Rabbi Yehuda. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda's position? So this could be one of two questions. It could be, how does he know you get 40? Or how does he know that the 40th lash goes between the shoulders? That could be the nature of the question. The answer is, Dichtiv, the Pasuk says, Ma makot eile ben yadecha, v'mar asher huketi beit mahavai. What are those injuries, hits that you sustained between your hands, your arms, or your fingers? Not clear what the word yadecha means over here. V'mar asher huketi beit mahavai. It's because I got hit at my beloved's house. So you can interpret beit mahavai in one of two ways. I'm going to see that. Rabbi Yehuda interprets beit mahavai to the beitin. It's a place where they love you. The Beit Din gives you lashes because they love you. They want you to do what you're supposed to do. They want to put you on the Derech HaYashar and have you keep the word of the Torah. So when they give you lashes, it's not a vindictive type of punishment. It's a punishment in order to demonstrate their love for you and direct you in the right direction. And that's what it means. You're getting lashes, Beit Mahavai, the Beit Din. And that, Ma'al Makot Eilu Ben Yadecha. Those makot are between your arms or between your shoulders on your back. And that's what Rabbi Yehuda said in the Mishnah. The 40th lash goes on your back. Now, if it's also proving that there is a 40th lash, then it really should have said mahamakeh hazeh, not mahamakot eile in the plural. So that's why some say it's just telling you where you get the 40th lash. The Ritva suggests that mahamakot eile is speaking about all of the makot together, not just the 40th lash. But all those that go on the back of the individual, that this is included. There's an additional makeh that goes between the back, but it's amongst the others that are given Beit Mahavai. And the Aruch Maner over here has a nice explanation where he suggests that the Ma Makot Eilev Ben Yadecha refer to all the makot that you're given up to the point of the 39, which are Kedei Rishato, the things that are associated with the onus or punishment for this infraction. And then the last one is Esher Huketi Beit Mavai, is the last one of the makot, which is number 40, which is differentiated from the other 39, which were associated with the punishment. And here is one that's given out of love, or a makah that is directive in nature, and therefore it's considered or classified as a hitting of love,
And that's only speaking about that 40th or last makah that he receives. So it's almost one for good luck on top, which says the 39 were your punishment, and here's one to tell you what you should be doing. And that way it would conceptually preserve the idea of Mishulash for Rabbi Yehuda, and that the extra makah is just an additional one out of love that sits on top of the 39.
So that way we bring a quasi-proof to Rabbi Yehuda's position that there is such 40th lash for El Balnon. The Rabbanu would disagree and say there are 39 lashes. What do they do with this pasuk? How about Tino Coach, a Beit Rabbanu Dichtir? That's being about kids in school. Beit Mavai, again, is school, where the teacher sometimes hits the students. They don't hit the students. Again, vindictively, they do it in order to direct the students to do the right thing or make the right decisions. I sustain those blows in school. The teachers and the educators were putting me on the right path, and therefore I sustain the blows, Beit Mavai. That's how they explain it, so that it doesn't have any impact on Beit Din or the procedures of Beit Din. Now we have Enom Dim Elam Makot Arayot Lishtalesh. And then the Mishnah went on to explain to us that if there's a change in the assessment, how we go about dealing with that change in the assessment. Laka in, lo laka lo. From our Mishnah, it seems pretty clear that only if you did get the Malkot do we say what's done is done and we dismiss you. But had you not gotten the Malkot, it seems like we would undermine or we would change our mind. We would reassess the situation and deal with the new assessment. So in the case in the Reisha, where he was assessed to do 40, and all of a sudden they start going, and they say, you know what, he can't make the 40, we got through 18. The only reason we say now, let him go and he's done, is because he already got 18 lashes in Beit Din. We say that he already suffered, he already got what was due to him, let him go. On the other hand, implied in that is if had they yet to give him the lashes, then now we assess him to get 18 instead of 40, that would not be the case. You would not get dismissed with 18. Or vice versa. In the Seifa, it says that we assessed him to get 18, and then we figure out after he gets the 18 that he could have gotten much more, the 40. But he already got the 18. So we say he got his 18, let him go. Had we reached that a conclusion beforehand, it makes it sound like that we would not dismiss him with 18, we would make him get the full 40. That's the implication the deal could have our Mishnah. Beraminu, the problem is we have a Braita that seems to disagree with that. Amdu al kabel arbaim, they assessed him to get 40. V'chazru v'amdu shen yechol kabel arbaim. And then they reassessed him and realized he can't get the 40. So here you have a completely new assessment. It wasn't in fact that they whipped him and they gave him a coat and they realized that it's not going to happen. Here they reassessed him and they realized that he cannot take the 40. Patur. He is patur. It seems like the simple reading of the Gemara is patur legamre, that you don't have to get anything here. You don't get absolutely nothing. Amdu lekabel shmonesre. If they assessed him to get 18, v'chazru v'amdu, again, they reassessed him later. Sheyachol lekabel arbaim, and now they say he can get 40. Patur. Again, here you have the word patur. In both cases, the simple reading would be patur legamre, which is very surprising. But the main focus of the Braita is the fact that it never says you have to get the Malkot in order for this to be true. It simply says the reassessment is enough to dismiss the situation rather than a case where you got Malkot, he's nitbazeh bebeit din, and we say, all right, he got what he needed to get, let him go. Over here he got nothing. And yet the reassessment has impact. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Sheshi lo kasha, that's not a problem. Amdum du liyome. It's a case where he did it for the day, or a case where he did it for the next couple of days. So most of the Rishonim read this the same way, even though they come to very different conclusions, which is that our Mishnah is talking about Biyomei. It's a case where on the same day, they assess the individual for what they could handle on that day, and then later on that same day, they reassess the individual. As opposed to the Braita, where they assess them up front for a period of time, a duration, and then they reassess them at a later date. So in our Mishnah, the way that the Rivan reads it, is that you have a situation in which on the same day they realize that their assessment was misplaced. And since they realize on the same day that their assessment was misplaced, the way that the Rivan reads it is that we have a problem now. When you reassess on the same day, you can't claim that the guy's physical standing changed. It's not now that all of a sudden, 2 hours later, he's much weaker than he was when you originally assessed him. Obviously, the fact is that you made a mistake in your original assessment. And since you made a mistake in your original assessment, now we have to look at the situation and determine what we do. So in the case where he started out with the 40, and now we reassess and say he can't handle the 40, what you're saying is the original assessment was incorrect. It was totally wrong, because nothing changed about this guy. That means that you gave an incorrect assessment. Now let's reassess. And the same would be true vice versa, which is in the case where originally you thought he could take 18, and now he can take 40, you would assume that the first assessment was wrong, and now he should get 40. That's the way the Rivan explains it. The Ramban, following the same shita, gives a different reason for why in the second case we don't give the 40 malkot, which is the fact that we have a principle by dinei nefashot that if a person is found to be innocent, even though he wasn't innocent, once we release him from the court, he's done. Once he was let go, we don't bring him back to court to deal with the case again. And he says the similar thing happens over here. By the case of the Malkot, which we saw in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, is quasi-capital punishment, over there we're going to suggest that when he got the original assessment of 18, basically he was dismissed from court with a punishment of 18. But now you reassess it to 40, you're trying to reopen the case where he was already dismissed with 18, and you're not allowed to do that, you can't reopen the case. And an omed, an assessment, is considered to be a din, and once you have a din, you can't reopen that din. Now the nafka mina between these two reasons would actually be whether he didn't get the malkot. In the case of the Ramban, it's irrelevant whether you got the malkot or not. The first assessment is basically a decision that says that you will be dismissed with this lower amount, and we cannot undermine that unless really there is a change in the status of the individual. But here, where clearly there was no change in status of the individual because you're reassessing him on the same day, then he got lucky and they misassessed him at first. And if you're dismissed from court in a capital case, then we don't bring you back, but we don't reassess it. And so therefore, the Ramban, it would make no difference whether you got or did not get the Malkot. And then additionally, the difference in those opinions actually lead to a difference in where you think the problem of the Braita is. The Braita, which says that it's irrespective of whether you get Malkot or not, according to the Rivan, that's a problem both for the Reisha and the Seifa of the Mishnah. On the other hand, for the Ramban, it's only a problem in the Reisha of the Mishnah, because the Reisha Mishnah differentiates between whether he did or did not get the Malkot. On the other hand, according to the Ramban in the second half of the Mishnah, it's irrespective of whether you got the Malkot or not, and that actually is in line with what the Braita says. Therefore, for the Ramban, only the first part of the Mishnah is a steer to the Braita, not both cases of the Mishnah. Therefore, according to the Ramban, in the situation where you have yet to give the Malkot in our Mishnah, in the second case of the Mishnah, which is a case where they originally assessed him for 18, and now they've upgraded it to 40, in the case where you have yet to get Malkot, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get the full 40, because we assume that the first assessment was incorrect. And given that it was incorrect, now we upgrade you to a full 40, and you have to get the full 40 Malkot, which you are capable of handling. On the other hand, in the case of the Reisha, where you were downgraded, originally we thought you had 40, and now you're going to get 18, then in that situation, we would have assumed that the first assessment is incorrect. But in this situation, if you got Malkot already, we clearly dismiss you. But if you did not get Malkot, if we said then you also get 18, that's where the Rivan points out, then there'd be no difference between the case of Laka and Enu Laka. For that reason, he believes that you still get 40 in the case where the Malkot were not given. And that is because we're choshesh for the fact that the original assessment was also good. And given that the original assessment might have been good, we now wait till you get healthier and can handle the full 40, and we give you the full 40 based on that original assessment of 40 in a case we have yet to get the Malkot. And it's only because you began to get Malkot, then we can undermine the first assessment and change our mind, because now we see that there's physical evidence of the fact that the first assessment was incorrect. And so therefore, in the case of the Reisha, where he went from being able or capable of taking 40 down to 18, if they're already giving him Malkot, and we see that there's a real change in the status of the individual, then we can undermine or dismiss the original assessment and say that we need to go with the new assessment. The other hand, if you just simply reassessed it on that day, we question the authenticity or veracity of that assessment because the original assessment said otherwise. And since we're choshesh for that original assessment, we assume that the person can handle 40 and we just have to wait for him to get healthy again so that he can take the full 40.
So the Ramban says we just followed the Omed Hasheni because the first Omed was problematic, and therefore you get the lower number now, which is the 18, as opposed to the Rivan, who thinks you wait around until he gets healthier to give him that first number. In the latter case of the Mishnah, where he had originally been assessed to do 18, and then we upgrade to 40. Again, if he got the Malkot already, he was done, nitbazeh, and we let him go. Because as the Rivan says, it would be a bizayon to Beit Din to bring him back, and by that way indicate that Beit Din made a misassessment of the situation. Therefore, he got his bizoy. Beit Din doesn't want to undermine what they did already, and we leave him with 18 that he already received. In a case where he does yet to have the Malkot, the second case of the Mishnah, we assume there when he went from 18 up to 40, we worry about the fact that the first assessment was problematic, and therefore we're going to upgrade that assessment to assume that the individual could handle the 40. In those cases, both instances, he would get the full 40 in the reassessment case, either by waiting in the first case, or in the second case, seems like now we think he is capable of handling it, and we'll give it to him right away. Now that is in distinction to the Braita, where the assessment is done on a different day. And since it's done on a different day, here you have a plausible explanation that the individual's physical capacity to handle Malkot, his well-being has changed over that period of time. And since his well-being has changed, we say there is a possibility he weakened, possibility that the original assessment was correct. And therefore, according to the Rivan, in the case where you went from 40 down to 18,
40 down to 18, or the way the Rivan seems to indicate is that he now can't take any Malkot at all.
And we can't be Mikayim, the Omid of the 40, by giving you 18.
Or your assessment now currently is that you can't get any Malkot.
The Rivan seems to indicate over here that the Patur means Patur the Gamre. The person is dismissed Patur without getting any Malkot whatsoever.
Because we assume that the Omed HaRishon, the first assessment was good, and now that you can't take any more, you were already nitbazeh by the Omed, that's what the Rivan says, and therefore you've discharged your obligation. On the other hand, the Ramban says the reason that we don't give you anything here, again, if the number went down to 0, or even if it went down to 18, is because ein omdim oto pam sheni. We don't assess him a second time. Even though something's changed with the individual, we don't bring him almost out of a double jeopardy situation. We don't assess him again. We don't bring him to din again. And he says, din min shemaya hu dechasu alei. They had rachamim on him in a shemaim. Now he will get nothing. And therefore he is totally free, even though he got no malkot whatsoever. If he went from 18 up to 40, we'll also give him 18. Because we're going to assume that the assessment of the 18 is correct, then we're going to only give him 18 and dismiss him based on those 18. Since in the Braita we always assume that the Omed HaRishon is correct, because it only happened after time that there was a change, as opposed to the Mishnah where we assume that there are questions or aspersions on the Omed HaRishon because of the fact that you reassessed on the same day. Whereas the Balei HaTosafot have just the opposite view. The Meiri and the Balei HaTosafot suggest that the Patur over here means that you're Patur from the Omed HaRishon, which means the first assessment, but you're Chayav in the latter assessment because we assume that the latter assessment is correct in this situation. And so therefore, in the first case of the Braita, you will get nothing, because we assume the second Omed is the correct assessment, and now when we're saying you can't take anything, we'll give you that. And in the second case of the Braita, we're going to give you 40, because that's the new assessment, and the second assessment is correct, as opposed to the Rivan, who believes that the first assessment's correct, and you only get the 18. If you look in Agota Bach, he claims that the Pshita of Tosafot over here is similar to that of the Rivan, and that you would also only get the 18 over here. Whereas in the Mishnah, the Tosafot thinks that if there were no Malkot given, in the case of 40 down to 18, then you would go with the 40, and we follow the first assessment, coming to a similar conclusion as the Rivan, which means that you're going to have to wait now until you can handle the 40. Whereas in the case where it went from 18 up to 40, we're going to go Batar Sheni, we're going to go after the second assessment, again, similar to what the Rivan concluded, that we will now give you the full 40, because we assume that the first assessment wasn't any good.
Right, now in the next Mishnah, Avar Aveira, Sheesh Ba Shnei Lavin, the person violated an Aveira that has two Lavin, Amdu Omed Echad, if they assessed him one assessment,
loke upatur. You'll get the malkot and then be dismissed. Bimlav, if not, loke umitrape, bechozer beloke. He gets the malkot for the first violation, then recuperates, and then they give him malkot for the second violation. Vatanyo, don't we have a braita? Inum dim omer echad dishnei lavin. Don't we have a braita that tells us you're not allowed to make one assessment for two different violations? I'm Rav Sheshet. So once again, Rav Sheshet comes to the rescue to reconcile between the Mishnah and the braita and says, Lokasha, Adam du'al arba'im v'chada, Adam du'al arba'im v'tarte. Depends on the assessment that they gave him as to what he can sustain. The minimum that you have to give him for the first violation is 39 malkot. If you assess him to handle 39 malkot, we will say that those cover the first violation. Anything in excess of that 39 can then be assigned to the second violation. But at minimum for the second violation to be counted over here, you need a minimum of 3 malkot. And that is because, as we said in the Mishnah, only in multiples of 3 do we give malkot. And so what Rav Sheshet points out is, if we assume that the person can handle 41 malkot in one shot, that means he'll get 39 for the first violation. The additional 2 then would go towards the second violation. But 2 doesn't meet that minimum threshold of 3, and therefore we wouldn't give him those malkot of 2, and then we would allow him to recuperate, and then reassess the situation, and then give him another 40 or whatever he can handle once he is recuperated for the second violation. On the other hand, if he can handle in the first time 42 malkot, which means 39 for the first violation, and an additional 3 then which would cover the second violation, and that meets the minimum threshold, then that would dismiss both violations with a complete 42 malkot be given in one shot. So the idea being that the omed, we consider the assessment up front to be dealing with both issues. But if the omed can't reach a level that will allow us to address both lavin, then we'll only handle one lav at a time. And then if the omed gives us the possibility of dealing with both of them in one shot, we will give him the malkot that are assessed, and that will cover both violations. So it will turn out to be a kula. The more you can handle up front will be a kula, because in that way you could then dismiss both lavin with getting a sum total of less, which is total of 42. The other hand, if you can't handle the 42 and only 41, then the individual would get 39 now, recuperate, and then get another 39 later. So actually get more, even though the person is weaker, because of the fact that you can't handle enough to cover both lavin in that one shot. We'll do the next Mishnah, which is Ketzad Malkinoto. How do we give the Malkot? Kofesh Teyedav Ala Amud. You tie his two hands to the pole, which is the whipping pole, the whipping stand. Helach Velech. You tie his hands on either side of the pole, or you could have here that they have two amudim. There are two poles there, and they tie the hands, one hand to each of the two poles, in order that the individual then is spread out and his back is open to accept the lashes that are going to be placed on his back. And the Chazana Knesset Ochez Bibgadav. The Chazana Knesset grabs onto his clothing, so he grabs onto his collar, and then grabbing onto his collar, bring him in to rip off the shirt or take the shirt off the individual. Im nikru, nikru. If they rip, that's fine. Vim nifru, nifmu. If they come into tatters, then that's also fine. Nifmu is like a finer ripping. It is a more extensive destruction of the garment. Rabbi Yehudah says that nikru means not along the seam lines, and nifru means that it's torn along the seam lines. So we don't worry about the details of how the shirt comes off, if it rips, it tears, everything like that. That is all part of the procedure here to bring the individual to the makot. Ad shumigalet libo, in order to expose his heart, or basically to remove the shirt from the individual to get the lashes, because you want the lashes to be on his body, not have the beged be a hefsek between the lashes and the body of the individual. The language that's used here is very similar to the language that's used by the sota. When she's dragged around, we drag her around, we don't worry about how the beged tears when we do this. And similarly over here, the handling of the individual, we're not giving them kid gloves. The handling of the individual is part of the punishment. The embarrassment that's associated with that and how they're handled is part and parcel of the bizoy from the malkot that you're going to get. Now, as far as the word chazan ha-kneset, the Rivan over here says he doesn't know what the word chazan means. or the etymology of the word, and as to why he's the individual that does it, clear here that he's the shliach Beit Din that is going to give the lashes and work on behalf of the Beit Din. In the Marshal, he says that the word chazan comes from the word chuzet, to see. This is an individual who looks out to see what the needs of the city are, and what the needs of the Beit Din are, and that's why he's called chazan HaKnesset. Then, ha'evin netunah me'achorav, there is a stone upon which the whipper stands behind the individual. Chazan HaKnesset omed alav. The Chazan HaKnesset stands on that stone in order to give lashes. This we'll see later on becomes somewhat problematic as to the placement of this stone. The idea being that he's up on the stone to give himself more power, equivalent of a pitcher's mound being raised so that the pitcher has a better angle when he's pitching to bring the ball down with force. Similarly over here, in order to bring the whip down with force, if the Chazan HaKnesset is up higher, he can bring it down with more force. For Ritzuabiyado, he has the whip in his hand. Shel Egel Kfuda. It is made out of leather from a calf. Echad Shnaim Ushnaim the Arba. And that is folded one into two, two into four. Ushtei Ritzuot Shel Chamor Olot V'Yordot Ba. And then you have two pieces of leather from a donkey that are somehow attached to it that go up and down. So here there are a number of explanations as to how the whip looks. The first thing is that the Gemara will discuss why we use these particular animals, an egel and a chamor. That's based on the pasuk in Yeshayahu Aleph, which is Yada Shor Koneyu v'chamor avus ba'alav, that the shor knows its owner, and the chamor, the trough from which it eats. And my nation didn't understand who their God was, and therefore they went astray. So also over here, it's a musar to the individuals getting whipped, that this person doesn't know who his real boss is, he doesn't know who his real adon is, but a animal knows where it gets fed, and therefore the animal always goes back to its master, it always accedes to the wishes of its master. So too, this individual should learn the lesson that he needs to listen to his master, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that explains why they use a whip that includes a chamor. As far as an eagle is concerned, the Gemara uses the juxtaposition of lo taksom shor b'disho, that is juxtaposed arbeim yakenu, or you could argue that it also derives from the pasuk in Yeshayahu that says yadash shor koneu chamor abus balav, because those are the two animals that are mentioned over there. So now that explains the materials. In terms of how you make it, there is a question as to whether you have two ropes, strands of leather from a calf, and you fold over each one of them. So now you have two strips of leather that have now been folded back on themselves, and they create two loops at the top. Or whether this is one strip of leather that is folded over once, and then folded over twice, in order to create a case where there are two loops at the top. So now, according to most, that's it. They remain as loops, and then they are whipped. Now, the reason that you do this is so that at the bottom, you have the base of the leather, the beginning of the leather, and you can retract or extend the whip to be the right length, as we're going to see in a second, that it needs to subjectively be lengthened or shortened, depending on the individual who is being whipped. Now, the Ritva agrees to that explanation that it is one that is being folded twice, but then he says that they cut the loops at the top, so it actually makes it into loose pieces of leather at the top. They're like free flying four different whips that are at the top. Now as far as adding on the pieces of the chamor, here the Rivan brings two explanations. One explanation is actually that the pieces of the chamor are actually in the middle of the whip of the egel, and they are stitched on over there. And olot v'yordot comes from when the Chazan HaKnesset is lifting up the whip and lowering the whip. Those little pieces of leather in the middle of the egel leather go up and down based on the direction of the arm of the Chazan HaKnesset. The Rivan brings this in the name of Rashi's Rebbeim. On the other hand, Rashi seems to favor an explanation which says that the way that the leather of the chamor is woven into the leather of the egel is through an up and down motion. The olot v'yordot is not about how they move once they're attached, rather, how they're affixed to the leather of the egel. The leather of the chamor is woven in up and down. The Ritva then brings another possible explanation, which is that the leather of the chamor is attached to the leather of the egel, but as we're going to see a second in the Mishnah, they lengthen and shorten the length of the whip depending on the individual, and therefore olot v'yordot bo is that the chamor moves up and down depending on how long the whip is. And the olot v'yordot is telling the placement of where those little pieces of chamor leather are dependent on how you lengthen or shorten the whip. I think that you could also possibly explain that the leather of the chamor are at the tips, at the way end, especially according to those Rishonim that believe that we leave the leather of the egel folded over, then the little pieces of chamor, instead of being halfway up, could be at the tip or the ends over there. And that's what it means that they're olot v'yordot. They fly freely, independent of the leather of the egel. And that is because they are the little extra whip that is at the end where the loop happens for the leather of the egel. And that might be what it means, olot v'yordot, because they are the extension, in a sense, of the whip beyond the fold at the end of the whip, where they give that little extra snap to the whip. Yada tefach. So its handle is a tefach long. Virachba tefach. And it is a tefach wide. The way the Rivan explains this is that there is some sort of handle or wooden handle that is a tefach long, to which the leather returns, meaning the two ends of the leather come there, because you folded the leather over in order to get the whip. And so those two ends are affixed to this handle, wooden handle that you have there. And that is what it means, that it's a length of a tefach. The width of a tefach seems to be speaking about the leather of the egel, that the whip itself, the leather is a tefach wide in terms of the egel's leather, because again, in terms of length-wise, that'll be adjusted according to the person, but width-wise, it's a tefach wide. There are others that suggest that there is no handle here, but rather the gathering or tying of the leather together that makes the handle. That handle is a tefach long, but it's a tefach not of a separate handle, but of the materials themselves that make up the whip. V'rosha magad al pi kreso, and the ends of the whip reach until the stomach of the individual. This is where the Rivan says that the way they whip the individual was not along the back, up and down the back, rather across the back of the individual. Then that's somewhat contradicted by what the Mishnah said earlier, that the stone upon which the whipper stands is right behind the individual being whipped. So if that's the case, how do you hit across the back of the individual if it's set up in a way that you're going to come down alongwise on the back of the individual? So there are those that believe that a pikreso doesn't mean literally on his stomach, but rather in the area of when his stomach is, that's where you hit him on the back, but you do hit him up and down the back. On the other hand, the Rivan just says that yes, the stone is behind, but the person who's whipping turns his body in such a way that when he brings the whip down with his arm, it goes across the back of the individual and not up and down the back of the individual. And so what it means, Bagata Pikreso, means that you whip him across the back, and the whip reaches the point where it goes around, wraps around the back a little bit and touches the belly of the individual. And that's what it means, a pikreso, and that determines the length of the whip. How long does the whip have to be? It has to be long enough that when he comes down across the back of the individual, it will then touch pikreso. Makeoto shlish milafanav ushte yadot miacharav, and he gets 1/3 of the lashes in front and 2/3 of the lashes behind. Now the 1/3 that are in front, it sounds like from this Mishnah that you would get those in the area of the belly, and then the 2/3 in the back are on the back opposite the area of the belly across the back. Although the Rambam says that when you hit him in the front, you hit him on the chest and not on the kreso. That might also relate to the Rambam's position that when you hit him in the back, you don't hit him across the back, but you hit him on each shoulder. And therefore, there's actually 3/3 that are given here. There's a 1/3 given on the chest, then a 1/3 given on each shoulder. So the Rambam reads it both as being connected, the location as well as the number. Whereas the Ritva says that you could read it simply as connected means opposite. So therefore, you give him 1/3 in the front and 2/3 on the back, but the 2/3 in the back are all in the same location, opposite of where you give him in the front. And depending where you think you give him in the front, whether it's connectedly bow, around where his heart is or his chest, there on the back, you would give him the same location. Or if you give it on his belly in the front, then you would give it on his back, around the area of the belly on the back. Veino makeoto lo omeid velo yoshev. You do not give him the lashes while he's standing erect or when he's sitting down. Ele muteh. He has to be bent over. And that's the reason they used the whipping stand,
which the Rivan earlier noted was 1.5 to 2 amot high,
is because of the fact that now they can tie his hands to the side and force him to be leaned over. So the height of the stand obviously would have to be adjusted for the individual so that he is kept in this somewhat bent position. Shnemar v'pilo ha-shofet, because it says that the shofet will push him over or bend him over. So it doesn't mean sitting or standing, but that he should be bent over. V'amakeh makeh b'yado achat. The whipper uses one arm, b'chol kocho, and he brings it down with all of his strength and all of his power. Va'kore kore, and then you have an individual there who's reading the psukim at the same time that the lashes are going on. The source for that is the fact that by Parsha Kedoshim, when it speaks about the Shifcha Harufa, it says Bikoret Tiyeh. And the Gemara there dashins that Bikoret Tiyeh is with regards to the Malkot. And it dashin the word Bikoret to be Bikriya Tiyeh. That there should be a reading of the Psukim at the same time that this is going on. And that is that they read the following Psukim. Im lo tishmor la'asot et kol divrei ha-Torah zot ha-ktuvim ba-sefer zeh. Yirat Hashem nichbad nora ze et Hashem elokecha vifla Hashem et makotcha vet makot zarecha makot gdolot v'nemanot v'chalaim ra'im v'nemanim. And then in our mission it says v'chuzer l'tchilat ha-mikra, and it goes back to the beginning, meaning that they keep repeating this as they're going through the lashes. If you have that girsa here, that would be the end of the Mishnah. You can see that Ot Aleph in the Gra, but seemingly eliminates the remainder of that which is found in the Mishnah. And many Rishonim also do that. They didn't have this girsa in the Mishnah. Some Mishnayot, including the Mishnah we have in our Gemara, have an additional item here, which is Ushmartem et Abrit Azot Vasitem Otam Lamanta Skilu et Kosher Tasun. And then v'chuteim, you end off with v'hurachum yichaper avon lo yeshchit v'bashivapo v'lo yirkoch amoto v'chuzer l'tchilat ha-mikra. And then you go back to the beginning again. So obviously, if you think that the Mishnah includes these psukim, then you would eliminate v'chuzer l'tchilat ha-mikra, the first one, and you would only have it over here. If you think that you only have the first psukim, then you leave v'chuzer l'tchilat ha-mikra and you eliminate these psukim and v'chuzer l'tchilat ha-mikra that's found here at the end. And as the Marsha explains over here, the reason you read these psukim are to indicate to the individual as to why he's getting the malkot. Because you didn't keep the mitzvot Hashem, which is the nature of the psukim, telling you that you did something wrong. And when you do something wrong, Hashem brings punishment, makot, chaleim, and all these difficulties upon the individual. And you're reading the psukim so that a person understands that these lashes are coming because of his violation of the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now the Tosfot read obviously includes the girsa of the additional psukim. Says that the reason these psukim were picked is because they have 13 words in them. So with the exception of the first pasuk, which has more, the subsequent three psukim have 13 words in it. And that leads some to say that the purpose of these psukim was to help with the counting of the makot. Because you give 39 makot, and here you have three psukim that have 13 words in them. And that would be the explanation, although that is rejected by other Rishonim, like the Rabbeinu Yonatan, and the explanation that we just brought by the Marsha, who say that the reason for these psukim are to tell the person why they're getting the malkot, and not as part of the count or a way to keep track of the count of the malkot that are being given. And that might influence which girsa that you have in the Mishnah. V'imei takan yado, if the shliach beitin in giving the malkot, the individual passes away, patur, then he doesn't have to go into galut. We saw that earlier in the Masechta, that a person who is acting as a functionary of the beitin and giving what was directed by the beitin, he's not subject to galut, similar to a rebbe and a father towards a child or a student. Hosif lo od ritzua achat. On the other hand, if he adds on an additional lash that he wasn't supposed to, umeit, and he dies, or he said golel yodo. Then he has to go to galut because then he exceeded his mandate as a shliach beitin, and in that capacity he killed someone b'shogeg, and now he has to go into galut for doing such. Nitkalkel ben berei ben b'mayim. If a person loses control of his functions, and therefore he either urinates or defecates on himself while he's getting whipped, patur, then we dismiss him immediately. The bizayon that comes from that is enough in order to obviate the need to do any more malkot, because part of the whipping or the lashing in such a public forum and session is the embarrassment that the individual feels, And that is part of the deterrent factor that we're trying to have. If the person soils themselves, that's already enough of an embarrassment or public embarrassment that we release him right away and say that he got what he deserved. Because it says, V'nikna achicha le'enecha, that your brother will be nikla. Nikla means that he will be embarrassed or denigrated, and that's what happened over here, V'nikla achicha le'enecha. Yehuda Meri, ish bereya isha b'mayim. That the threshold for embarrassment for a man and a woman is different. And therefore, by a man, if he defecates, that's enough embarrassment to release him. For a woman, if she simply urinates, that's enough of a reason to release her. Okay, we're going to stop here at the end of the Mishnah on the bottom of Chavbet Amudbet.